Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Did you know there was only one time in American history when five former presidents were alive to look upon their successor? And the time might surprise you. It was when Lincoln took office in 1861, and the men were John Tyler, Martin Van Buren, Millard Fillmore, Franklin Pierce, and James Buchanan. And their thoughts on the buildup to the Civil War, their thoughts about secession and slavery make for a fascinating read in the hands of the author of The President's War, Six American Presidents and the Civil War That Divided Them. You may think, as I did, you know, I don't know very much about these presidents. There are certain presidents you just don't know much about, and so it makes a valuable contribution to our understanding of each of them. Krista Rose is the author, professor of constitutional law, and a political strategist, author of Congressman Lincoln, The Making of America's Greatest President, and Founding Rivals, Madison versus Monroe, The Bill of Rights and the Election That Saved a Nation. He has served in nearly every capacity on campaigns up and down the ballot in five different states. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Chris. Our phone number, as always, is 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter at K Dunn Show. Hi, Chris. Thanks so much for being with us.
Hey, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Well, what a contribution you have made, because I think I'm not alone in saying I don't know very much about those presidents, and yet you look at what each presidency led up to, ultimately a civil war. It's a pretty darn crucial time in our history.
Absolutely. Never more crucial. The Union itself and the balance, and the question of what kind of country were we going to have going forward? A united country, a divided country, with or without slavery? And you have these five living presidents, which is a record number, and you have all of them casting a skeptical eye on Abraham Lincoln. You know, each of them oppose his election as president, and each of them to varying degrees supports or opposes him during the great crisis that defined his presidency. So this book was every history lover's dream to write and hopefully to read.
Yeah, it really fills us in on such an important time. Did Lincoln actively campaign for any of these men who became president?
Well, he was a big fan of Millard Fillmore. So four of the five presidents are... Well, in 1840, you have John Tyler, who gets elected as vice president to William Henry Harrison, who, of course, we know dies a month after assuming the office of president, and is formally expelled from the Whig Party for taking the Whig Party on over the issue of a national bank. So Lincoln would have supported Tyler as Harrison's running mate. Similarly, in 1848, Lincoln was quite active in campaigning for General Zachary Taylor, whose running mate was Millard Fillmore, who, of course, became president upon Taylor's death. Now, Lincoln was one of the earliest proponents. In fact, Lincoln is in Congress at this time, and 1846 to 1848. And so Lincoln, or 47 to 49, excuse me. And so Lincoln is one of the first seven congressional supporters of Zachary Taylor. Hmm. And so he's very pleased with the choice of Fillmore as vice president. In fact, he goes and meets with him on his way home from Congress, and he campaigns throughout the country on behalf of that ticket.
Hmm. Let's spend some time on John Tyler, because he winds up becoming... a representative in the Confederacy of all places. How does he become a Confederate?
So for Tyler, you know, his viewpoints, he's a very strong states rightist, right? Mm-hmm. He has this idea that he sees America not as a nation, but as a collection of independent states. He sees Congress kind of how we would see a modern United Nations, you know, a place where these independent states could go and talk about things, maybe do things together, maybe not. So that was always his conception of how the Union worked. He's a Virginian. He is a prodigious slaveholder and supporter of the institution of slavery. He was one of five members of the House of Representatives to vote against the Missouri Compromise. So not someone willing to accept even some of the more popular and broadly palatable compromises on slavery from over the years. And so it's not a surprise that when Tyler can't get an accommodation for the South after Lincoln's election of some kind, that he withdraws. In fact, he serves in the Virginia Secession Convention, where he is perhaps the most influential member in trying to drive Virginia out of the Union and align it with the Confederacy.
And didn't somebody come to their house at some point and there was a Confederate flag flying over a mantelpiece and his wife denied that it was a Confederate flag? Was that Tyler?
Yeah, interesting story there. So Tyler, as president, Tyler's wife dies while he's in the White House. He marries a woman 30 years younger than him. He's 54, she's 24.
Whoa!
And she is a New York socialite who, you know, talk about the zeal of the converted. After they move to Virginia after his presidency, she becomes a full-blown Southerner in her viewpoints and her attitudes. And so she's very, very pro-South, very, very pro-Confederacy, pro-secession. And so Tyler dies during the war, and at some point during the war, she actually reluctantly leaves Virginia. You know, her home, their home, Sherwood Forest, is constantly back and forth, sometimes on behind Union lines, sometimes behind Confederate lines. There's a lot of fighting near their home. So when she's widowed, she goes to New York reluctantly to live with her family and help her watch her kids. She had a number of children with John Tyler, and the rumor was that she had a Confederate flag above her mantelpiece. And so when Abraham Lincoln was assassinated, there was this incredible feeling of melancholy, rage throughout the country. And so some young men showed up at her doorstep in New York saying, "Ma'am, we're going to take your Confederate flag away from you." And she said, "I don't have a Confederate flag. You're welcome to look around." And so what they did take was a flag above her mantelpiece. And I've seen this flag, and it looks an awful lot like the Stars and Bars, like the Confederate battle flag.
Uh-huh.
But apparently this was a flag that her sister had made 10 years before. And so she just happened to have it on the wall, and it wasn't to pay homage to the Confederacy. It was just a facsimile of the Confederate flag. So it was a misunderstanding.
Interesting. Who was the president who was on a Western campaign swing and stopped in Illinois and Abraham Lincoln was regaling him with stories?
I love this story. So Abraham Lincoln, you know, grows up, we're pretty familiar with his hard scrabble story, right? Desperately poor log cabin.
Yes.
We love it, and we should love it, right? And so Abraham Lincoln always has this almost delusional belief in himself that he is going to be president of the United States someday, and that someday he can transcend his humble conditions, and that he perhaps can become president of the United States someday. And so enter Martin Van Buren. Van Buren is defeated for re-election in 1840 in the midst of America's first economic crisis. He attempts to make a comeback 4 years later. And so he's traveling through the country to try to line up support for this comeback bid. He gets to Illinois, and that's the frontier at the time, right? I grew up in Illinois. We didn't think of it as the frontier when I was growing up. 19th century is very much the edge of civilization. And so his wagon gets stuck, and all the Democrats in Illinois are like, "We need to show this guy a good time, and here he is, his wagon's getting stuck on our roads. What are we going to do?" And so the Democrats sent for the funniest, most entertaining person they knew, which was a fellow state legislator of theirs named Abraham Lincoln. And so Van Buren becomes the first president that Abraham Lincoln ever meets. And I think it's a really formative experience for him because he gets to match wits with a president. You know, he gets to match wits with someone who knew the founding fathers, with someone who was the architect of the Democratic Party, who had made presidents. And so Abraham Lincoln was able to talk to him and interact with him and see, you know, he's not so very different from me. And so they had a wonderful night together that Martin Van Buren actually remembers for the rest of his life. In fact, in 1860, during that great secession winter, Martin Van Buren's in New York, and people are wondering, who is this Abraham Lincoln guy? We have the least experienced president, you know, in history, a guy that served one term in Congress 12 years earlier. We don't know much about him, you know, and he's coming in at the most pivotal time in American history. And Van Buren says, "You know what? I know this guy. I met him in Illinois many years ago, and I kept waiting to hear his name. I always figured something had happened to him." Yeah. Great story.
Yeah, it is a great story. So was he more supportive than the rest of these presidents in terms of supporting Abraham Lincoln's policies, in terms of embracing the Union?
Absolutely. And so I think we can say Martin Van Buren, and perhaps because of the fact that he dies in 1862, Martin Van Buren is the most unqualified supporter of President Lincoln. Mm. So when, you know, during that great secession winter, during all those last attempts at compromise, four out of the five presidents, everyone but Tyler, supports something called the Crittenden Compromise, which was basically to take the Missouri Compromise line and draw it to the Pacific Ocean, extend it west. Slavery gets some new territory, but we've at least decided this question forever, and the Civil War is averted. And so Van Buren's one of the supporters of the Crittenden Compromise. But once compromise fails and Fort Sumter is fired on, the American flag fired on, American forces fired on by the rebels, Van Buren and Fillmore and even James Buchanan support President Lincoln's military response. They blamed the Confederates for initiating the violence. Van Buren wrote a letter to a Union meeting near his home encouraging men to join the Union Army, especially if they didn't have families, and strongly supports what Abraham Lincoln does. Millard Fillmore also gives a speech in Buffalo saying, now that war is commenced, we have to rally around the flag, get behind our country. Buchanan, who spends much of the Civil War in what I can only characterize as a Nixon-esque quest for rehabilitation, he spends the war, part of the war at least, defending Lincoln's policies, hoping that if Lincoln was successful, that he himself would be vindicated. Obviously, we know that didn't happen.
Yeah, it sure didn't happen. The Missouri Compromise, when was the Dred Scott decision?
So the Dred Scott decision is issued just before James Buchanan's inauguration as president in 1857.
Okay.
In fact, Buchanan made a huge miscalculation here. He actually lobbied the Supreme Court. You know, the Supreme Court can write their decisions narrowly, or they can, you know, maybe to limit them to the specific facts in front of them, or they can write a broad, wide-ranging, sweeping opinion. And Buchanan actually lobbied the Supreme Court to issue a sweeping opinion. It's one of the only instances where you ever see in American history of a president working with Supreme Court justices to try to get the opinion he wants. But he figures that this would actually resolve the slavery question forever. You know, far from it, to take the most controversial issue in antebellum America, remove it from the political process, and for the Supreme Court to side with the most extreme pro-slavery faction of it, far from settling the issue, it almost guaranteed that we would have a civil war.
Yeah, how did that happen? I got to read more about that particular decision. You wonder how that happened, and they must have known what they were doing, that it would move us closer to a civil war, didn't they?
You know, I thought that they were, I think to some degree they were oblivious. You know, no one's ever going to give the Supreme Court credit for having their finger on the pulse of public opinion. And so you had a number of these judges, they were appointed for life. You know, Roger Taney, strong supporter of slavery from the state of Maryland, had served in Andrew Jackson's cabinet and was now Jackson's Supreme Court Chief Justice, had been appointed by him. And so he wanted to impose his view of the Constitution on the rest of the country. And of course, this was a very limited and I think erroneous view of the Constitution. But I think that they thought that they were settling the issue for all time.
Yeah.
Peace in our time, if you will.
Yeah, exactly. Chris, is there anything that John Tyler, his sympathies were somewhere else completely, Martin Van Buren, James Buchanan, Millard Fillmore, or Franklin Pierce could have done that would have averted a civil war?
I think if they had gotten Congress to go along with the Crittenden Compromise, mm-hmm. I think you would have seen the war averted for a time. And I say for a time because every time the South got something, you know, the presidency as an institution, right, these former presidents, and this is the reason they all opposed Lincoln, they saw him as a threat to the institution itself. You know, they saw the presidency as a conciliator in chief. The president was the person who sat on the teapot and prevented all these different forces from boiling over and threatening the Union. And so generally that meant compromising with or appeasing the Southern interest, right? And so every time the South got what it wanted, it came back for more. And so we were very close, I think, to the reopening of the African slave trade, or at least the South drawing a line in the sand on that issue, re-importing slaves into the country for the first time in 50 years, invading other countries to try to acquire new slave territory. So I'm not certain that the South would have been satisfied with the Crittenden Compromise, but it would have averted the war for a time. Now, in Tyler's case, Tyler is a member of the Virginia Secession Convention. Virginia is the largest state in the Union. It is a state with strong unionist sentiments, right? The home of George Washington and Jefferson and Madison and Monroe, you know, so inextricably intertwined with American history. And so, in fact, when the first vote is taken in the Virginia Secession Convention, the vote is 90-45 against secession. Tyler's one of the 45 voting for secession. So imagine if Tyler,
wow,
someone with the stature of a former president,
yes,
instead of trying to drag his state out of the Union, right? Because remember, from February until Lincoln gets inaugurated, there had been no more secessions, right? It seemed like the secessionist tide had stopped with Texas and states like Virginia, North Carolina, Tennessee, Arkansas, waiting and seeing, taking a wait-and-see approach. Mm-hmm. And so it was really important that Virginia stand still and support the Union. And so imagine if Tyler had lent his influence to the Union cause instead of the secessionist cause.
Right.
Could Virginia have possibly stayed in the Union, and with it, Tennessee, North Carolina, Arkansas? Are we looking at a totally different kind of war here?
Fascinating. And what about Lincoln's interactions with all of these former presidents? Did he seek their counsel?
He certainly did not. He knew correctly that their solutions had not stood the test of time. Mm. It did not stop them from offering their counsel. One exception to this, I think, would be on his way to be sworn in as president. Lincoln stops in Buffalo, where he is hosted by Millard Fillmore.
Mm-hmm.
And Lincoln actually publicly courts Fillmore during this process. You know, it's interesting. Fillmore is the last president we've ever had to this day who was neither a Democrat nor a Republican. He's a member of the Whig Party. And Fillmore runs as a third-party candidate for president in 1856, right? You have Buchanan, the Democrat, John C. Fremont, the Republican, Millard Fillmore, who's running on something called the American Party, a third party, also known as the Know-Nothings. And so Fillmore, you know, got around 20% of the vote. He was very popular in the border states. He won the state of Maryland. And so all of his supporters were kind of looking around saying, well, we need some guidance here. Who should we side with, the Republicans or the Democrats? And so in 1860, Fillmore was something of a kingmaker for this significant part of the electorate. So Lincoln goes to Buffalo, at least makes a pretense of, you know, kissing the ring, seeking his advice, seeking his friendship. But, you know, then later on in the war, when Fillmore writes him a 6-page letter trying to advise him on how to avoid war with Britain, Lincoln never responds.
Huh. He also turned on Lincoln over emancipation.
Fillmore. He totally did. Yeah, Fillmore, who starts off as one of the most vocal and supportive presidents, ex-presidents on the war effort. You know, Fillmore actually raises a National Guard unit in New York, the Union Continentals. So there were a group of older gentlemen such as himself who were not eligible for military service, but who dressed up in uniforms, did target practice, marched through the streets. And their purpose was twofold, really. Number one, it was to drum up support for the Union effort, you know, the pageantry and the showmanship. And they would escort soldiers to the train station. And also they were there as a home guard unit. I mean, if Britain had come into the war, Canada, which was still part of Britain, would have, you know, right across from Buffalo. And so Buffalo would have suddenly been on the front lines of the war. And so they would have been there in order to protect the city and prevent it from being destroyed as it had been in the War of 1812. But Fillmore, who is a rabid Unionist, you know, no one was more ready to go to war to preserve the Union than Fillmore, but no one was more reluctant to go to war than Fillmore to destroy slavery.
Hmm.
And with the issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation, Lincoln broadens the Union objectives mm-hmm. from keeping the country together to the destruction of slavery.
Oh,
and that Fillmore cannot abide.
Didn't Fillmore see that from the very get-go, that indeed it was about slavery?
You know, I think he certainly saw that it was about slavery for the South, that the South is seceding because of slavery. They're saying so in public documents, public proclamations. We are leaving because this institution is threatened. But for Fillmore, from Fillmore's perspective, you know, you had all kinds of Union people from the North in the Union cause who were divided on the issue of slavery. You know, someone like William Tecumseh Sherman, who was not only very comfortable with the idea of slavery, but perhaps could even be characterized as a supporter. Everyone from him to like David Lloyd Garrison, Frederick Douglass, you know, the abolitionists.
Mm-hmm.
So they all agree that they're fighting to put their country back together. And then there's a sharp division among the North as to, well, do we make the war longer? Do we eliminate the chance of compromise with the South in order to broaden these objectives to include the destruction of slavery? And so when Lincoln does so with the issuance of the preliminary Emancipation Proclamation in 1862 and the final Emancipation Proclamation January 1st, 1863, now this is a war where slavery itself is fighting for its very existence.
Mm. We welcome phone calls for our guest, who, as you can tell, is incredibly knowledgeable about this period prior to Abraham Lincoln. His book is The President's War. It's been getting rave reviews, 6 American Presidents and the Civil War That Divided Them. And those presidents are John Tyler, Martin Van Buren, James Buchanan, Millard Fillmore, and Franklin Pierce. We'll go to James Buchanan. next in some detail because he was the president right before Lincoln. And you wonder what his thoughts were and what his actions were as all of these states are breaking away from the Union. What a time, huh? Here's how you reach us. Feel free to do so. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. And we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Chris is the author of Congressman Lincoln, The Making of America's Greatest President, Founding Rivals, Madison versus Monroe, the Bill of Rights and the Election That Saved a Nation, named as the best political books of 2011 and 2013. He is a professor, our guest, of constitutional law and a political strategist. For the last 17 years, he served in nearly every capacity on campaigns up and down the ballot in five different states. To your phone calls and to James Buchanan next here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll go to phone calls in just one moment, 800-486-8655. Would this be a fair statement to say about Buchanan, who was in the White House when we're seeing these states secede? I have read that President Buchanan denied the legal right of states to secede, but he also believed that the federal government could not prevent them from secession. He hoped to have some kind of compromise, but the secessionist leaders weren't for compromise. Is that a fair assessment of his situation?
Yeah. President Buchanan, you know, is not the first president to confront this issue. I mean, we had had a secession crisis on our hands as early as 1832, right, when South Carolina first threatened to secede under President Jackson. Every time America had found a way to compromise its way out of things. And so from Buchanan's perspective, he's sitting in the White House. He has 16,000 troops under his command, three-fourths of which are west of the Mississippi River in places like Arizona, protecting settlers on the Western Front. And so he doesn't have any sort of military force that he can bring to bear on the situation. He believes he's legally prohibited from responding militarily in any way, and makes what I think is a mistake in telegraphing that. Because, you know, if someone tells you you're breaking the law, but they don't intend on doing anything about it, you know, that's a pretty strong encouragement. Also, when Buchanan starts the secession crisis that is triggered by Lincoln's election as president, Buchanan has some strong pro-Southern, pro-secession members of his cabinet. So Buchanan goes through several distinct phases where you have these arch-secessionists in his cabinet, including his Secretary of War, who commits one of the greatest acts of treason in American history, tries to redirect Northern arms to the South.
Oh.
And is stopped by the citizens of Pennsylvania. But then later on, when these secessionists leave the cabinet, he replaces them with good people like Edwin Stanton, who we know becomes Abraham Lincoln's second Secretary of War. Mm-hmm. And he starts to get a backbone, and he starts to get very firm. But as president, from his perspective, he said, you know, America's always found a way to compromise their way out of these problems. Things have been bad before. They were bad in 1850. They were bad in 1820. They were bad in 1832. Surely we'll find a way of compromising. And, of course, it didn't happen.
Hmm. Well, I want to talk more about 1832, but we have some phone calls, so we'll get back to 1832 in a moment.
Maybe we'll get questions on 1832.
Maybe we will. Corey in Watertown. Hi, Corey.
Yeah, how's it going, Kathleen?
All right, Corey, how are you?
Oh, just fine. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
The way I was taught was the reason that Lincoln went to abolish slavery wasn't exactly because he was against slavery so much as it was that there was the economic force of the South. When the succession was going to be successful, that was his option to stop their economy from functioning by freeing the slaves, because the North was, their economy wasn't strong enough to be able to support the Union. That's what I was taught.
What do you teach, Chris?
Well, I think that's an incredibly good point that Corey made. And I think regardless of how a president felt about slavery, personally for it or personally against it, it's not a good thing when you're at war with someone who has 4 million free laborers. That's generally not a great thing, right? And so going freeing the slaves of the South, creating a framework under which Southern slaves could be freed, could be removed from the Confederate war effort, that's obviously a very important war measure.
Mm-hmm.
As to Lincoln and what he believed on slavery, this has been an issue of much discussion, but from my perspective, isn't worthy of much debate. If you go back, the first thing you have to understand about Abraham Lincoln, he is born in Kentucky, and he lives most of his adult life in the state of Illinois, right? Illinois at this time, according to the Liberator, which was the anti-slavery paper of record, was essentially a slave state. You know, as I said before, I grew up in Illinois. We didn't think of ourselves as a former slave state when I was growing up. But Illinois was settled from the south to the north. It was settled from Kentucky and upward rather than from the north to the south. And so linguistically, culturally, ethnically, politically, Illinois is a southern state in many respects. And according to the Liberator, it's, for all intents and purposes, a slave state. So that is where Lincoln is living. That is the mood of the electorate that Lincoln represents. And yet when Lincoln is in the Illinois legislature, he is one of the only legislators to dissent on a series of resolutions which were supportive of slavery. And in fact, he was the only one who was actually running for re-election out of the group that opposed these pro-slavery resolutions. Then when he gets to Congress, he introduces a bill to abolish slavery in the District of Columbia. And in the Pacheco slave case, where a family is trying to get their money back for a slave that was taken from them by the federal government, he refuses to recognize that property interest in a human being. So he votes over 40 times for the Wilmot Proviso, which prevents slavery from expanding into the territories. So you would be very hard-pressed to look at Lincoln's long career in politics and find a vote that was pro-slavery, to uphold the institution of slavery. So Lincoln voted against slavery every opportunity that he could, nearly every opportunity that he could, and even sponsored some important legislation in that regard. And he did it in a way that got him no credit from his constituents. His constituents were pro-slavery, or at least ambivalent about it.
That's fascinating. Yeah. Include this in the book. I can't remember if this is a true story or it's told in relation to something else, where he's making this, the nation cannot exist half slave and half free. And who's he saying that to? It's like right before he goes to sleep somewhere.
Yes, he is riding the circuit. So back in those days, as a lawyer, right. You couldn't make enough money practicing in one county. And so he and these other lawyers would travel county to county, county seat to county seat. They'd sign up clients, and then the judge that traveled with them would hear the cases. And so he's out riding the circuit when he hears that in 1854 that Congress has repealed the Missouri Compromise. The Missouri Compromise, which had held this country in place since 1820, now all of a sudden, Missouri Compromise had set a line. North of the line, you could not have slavery. South of the line, slavery would be permitted when in the territorial phase. So Kansas is a northern territory. It is above the Missouri Compromise line. And yet in the Kansas-Nebraska Act, Congress repeals the Missouri Compromise and says, well, Kansas is going to have a vote on whether or not to be free or slave, rather than honoring the Missouri Compromise. And that, Lincoln is going through a midlife crisis at this point. He served his term in Congress. He voted against the Mexican-American War. He was very unpopular for that. He may have been defeated for re-election if he had run. He's going through this midlife crisis where he's thinking, did I make the right decisions in life? Did I marry the right person? Did I pick the right job for me? And he's really losing focus on politics. This guy had been this incredible political animal who believed from the earliest days of his life that he'd be president someday. And here he is losing interest, just practicing law. And then he said he was aroused as never before when Congress repealed the Missouri Compromise. And so this really animated him and brought Abraham Lincoln back into politics.
Oh, fascinating. And one guy we haven't mentioned very much is the man who was president during that time was Franklin Pierce. And what were his thoughts about the Missouri Compromise?
Well, Franklin Pierce was very, very pro-South. Franklin Pierce laid all the blame for the Civil War on Northern abolitionists and their agitations against slavery. In fact, 1860, that pivotal year where Abraham Lincoln's elected, Franklin Pierce starts out the year by trying to recruit Jefferson Davis to run for president.
Oh, my gosh. Really? Wow.
Yeah. Very close personal friends and had served as Pierce's Secretary of War. And so Pierce is trying to get Jefferson Davis to run for president. So then the war breaks out, right? Pierce gives a speech from the balcony of the Eagle Hotel in Concord, New Hampshire, where he says, if the South can't be convinced to return peacefully, then we have to let them go. There is no military solution that will work. It wouldn't be constitutional. And so we have to let them go if we can't entice them to say. But, you know, Pierce had a special place in his heart against abolitionists. He hated abolitionists. He thought that they were the reason that the war was happening. And so he continuously goes out and gives speeches against Lincoln. He supports political candidates that oppose the Lincoln administration. He gets to the point where he's managing state legislative races in New Hampshire, trying to get legislators elected who are not supportive of Lincoln.
Quite a story. Thank you so much, Corey, for your call. And let's go to John in Arizona. Must be one of your students, huh? Hi, John.
Hey, Kathleen. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good, good. Thank you. Just had a quick question for Chris. Originally, I thought I heard you say that some of the presidents originally backed President Lincoln at the onset of the war, but then eventually opposed him. So I was just wondering if there was a defining moment that was the catalyst for persuading them, or was it a slow process, i.e. the war policies of President Lincoln?
Yeah, very good question. So the breaking point between Lincoln and these ex-presidents who initially support him really could be fairly characterized as his issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation. So before you have the Southern objective, they're seceding to protect slavery. The North is pursuing the war in order to reunite the country. With the emancipation of, with the issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation, now slavery, the destruction of slavery, is part of the Union war objective. And so Fillmore was totally opposed to that. Franklin Pierce, who always opposed Lincoln, thought it was the darkest crime that had ever been committed by an American president. James Buchanan, even after 1864, when Lincoln is reelected over the opposition of all the living ex-presidents who endorsed George McClellan, in 1864, Lincoln is elected. The war is getting very close to the end, and James Buchanan is still talking about the idea of offering the Confederates a deal. They just didn't get it. These ex-presidents were relics of a previous time, and they didn't really understand the new world that they were living in.
It just makes Lincoln all the more solitary and burdened a human being, doesn't it, to not have the support of any of them? Goodness.
I totally agree. You know, it was a total paradigm shift in the institution of the presidency. And what should the president do, right? You have these former presidents. They see their job as to try to appease the South, make compromises, cut deals. Lincoln saw it as his job to stick to principle.
Thank you very much, John, for your call. And another John, this one from Milwaukee. Hey, John.
Hi, I was calling just to put a little bit into modern perspective, and I'm almost positive this was up until a year ago, and I would assume today yet, but John Tyler has two grandsons that are alive today. Hmm. And it's a president from the 1850s has two grandsons living in the United States today.
Oh, my. Do you know where they are, Chris?
Yes, one is in Virginia and still lives in Sherwood Forest. So Sherwood Forest, Tyler's home, actually plays a really important role in the book because at various times it's occupied by Union forces. At various times, John Tyler is living there during the war and then subsequently his widow and his children. So John Tyler was very prolific and his son followed after him. And so he has two grandchildren alive today, one of whom still lives at Sherwood Forest. In fact, Sherwood Forest is the only presidential residence that has presidential descendants still living there.
Huh. Anything else, John?
No, that's it. I just thought that was amazing that we have a president from 1850 who still has
grandsons
alive today.
Yeah, that is amazing.
My grandfathers were, one was a truck driver and one worked for the forestry department of the city of Chicago. And someone else alive today could say my grandfather was the 10th president.
Thanks very much for the call, John. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. We're talking this hour with the author of the book, The President's War, Six American Presidents and the Civil War That Divided Them. Krista Rose is our guest. It's really an engaging book. And it looks at these presidents we just kind of gloss over, and yet their action or inaction during the period of time right before the Civil War contributed to a civil war in the United States, and their thoughts, particularly on slavery, are fascinating. We also have the country expanding rapidly during this time period. We've got that California, we got the Texas issue as well, war with Mexico. So we're talking about all of that with our guest, who's the author of a couple other history books, and they have been really hailed as terrific books, Congressman Lincoln, The Making of America's Greatest President, and Founding Rivals, Madison versus Monroe, The Bill of Rights and the Election That Saved a Nation. both named by the Washington Post as one of the best political books of 2011 and of last year, 2013. This one is about Franklin Pierce, Millard Fillmore, James Buchanan, Martin Van Buren, John Tyler, and of course, Abraham Lincoln. Here's how you reach our conversation, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. And those of you who are interested in the president's tomorrow, really beautiful book on presidential libraries with lots of pictures. I've always wanted to, I've been to several, but to go to all of them would be fun. So we'll be talking this hour tomorrow about presidential libraries. I hope you'll join us. More phone calls, more conversation in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Our guest this hour is the author of The President's War, Six American Presidents, and the Civil War That Divided Them, John in Milwaukee. Hello. John, are you there? I don't know where John is, but I know what he wanted to talk about, and this is another theme that runs through the book. There are a lot of banking issues that sort of weave themselves in and out of many of these administrations, on the central bank, on tariffs. Let's see if John is there to ask this more completely. Are you there, John? No, he's gone. So take it from there, if you would, please, Chris. Well, what's all the controversy about banks?
Certainly. Well, you have three major issues that characterize the politics of America in the 19th century. You have slavery, of course. You have the tariff rate, the idea of what sort of tax are we going to impose on foreign goods, and will that tax be for revenue only, or will it be protectionist in nature, which was great for northern manufacturers but bad for southern agriculture. And then the idea of a bank that had the power to store federal deposits, to discount notes, to set monetary policy. And so Andrew Jackson, very much opposed to the bank, saw it as an anti-democratic institution, a corrupting institution, takes money from the bank. That critical season is when Fillmore and Pierce first enter politics in the House of Representatives, and they're fighting over the president withdrawing money from the National Bank of the United States. Of course, this issue will return in a big way when Tyler's elected president. The Whigs are very excited in 1840. They've elected a president of their own. They're finally going to get a national bank back again. Harrison, of course, dies in 30 days, is succeeded by his vice president, who didn't agree with the constitutionality of a bank.
Oh, my.
And so Tyler is formally expelled from the Whig Party, burned in effigy in front of the White House. His cabinet all resigns on him. Tyler starts looking around and saying, okay, how am I going to get another term as president? I'm kicked out of the Whig Party. So he first considers trying to be a Democrat, and he tries to lure Martin Van Buren out of that race with an offer of a Supreme Court seat. Of course, Van Buren declines. He's in a very good position to win. Then Tyler tries to run as a third party candidate and runs on the issue of annexing Texas, right, which he devotes all of his energies to try to bring the Republic of Texas, the independent Republic of Texas, into the Union as one of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately withdraws from that race in order to stop James K. Polk, the nominee of the Democrats, from losing the election and electing Henry Clay.
In Texas, let's talk a little bit more about this also weaves itself. Is there a lot of controversy about what should be done with Texas?
There's a tremendous amount of controversy over Texas. It's really the most controversial issue of the early 1840s because this area of Texas has successfully revolutionized against Mexico. They are independent. And the idea of some is, hey, let's bring Texas into the Union, right?
Mm-hmm.
It has been settled largely by Americans or people of the same stock as Americans. They have Republican ideals. They're very similar to us. It will give us all this access to the Gulf of Mexico, all this new territory for this very ambitious young country that the United States was in the mid-19th century. The reservations, of course, were manifold. The idea that Mexico still considered Texas part of her territory, so that annexing Texas almost certainly meant war with Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
but also anytime you talk about acquiring new territory as a country or in the 19th century, you implicate the slavery issue.
Right.
So Texas has slavery. Are we going to bring a new slave state into the Union? Are we going to expand the reach of slavery in so doing?
Mm-hmm. And what did Lincoln say about that?
Lincoln didn't see a problem with annexing Texas per se, but I don't know that Lincoln shared the zeal of his countrymen at that time for westward expansion. I think his perspective might have been, we're a small country with Republican ideals. They're a small country with Republican ideals. Let's exist side by side. But there's no special urgency in annexing them.
Mm-hmm.
And he strongly opposed the Mexican-American War.
As I'm looking at, and let me give our phone number again for you to join us in the last minutes of the show. You are ever so welcome to do so. The number is 800-486-8655. I think maybe one of the reasons, and I said at the beginning of this show, I'm sure I'm not alone in this. It's a period in history that I have not studied very carefully, nor have I known very much about John Martin Van Buren, James Buchanan, Millard Fillmore, or Franklin Pierce. And then I'm wondering, you know, we don't spend a lot of time on any of these guys. Is it indeed, Chris, because they were kind of, you know, wishy-washy, lackluster, not any of them very strong presidents that in an indirect way led us to the worst crisis in our history?
I think it's all of those things. I think the collective American memory has room for a handful of presidents, you know, people mm-hmm. like Washington, but even people like Jefferson, who are much more famous for things they did before they were president than things they did while they were president, right? Abraham Lincoln, of course, larger-than-life personalities like Teddy Roosevelt, presidents during major wars like Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt. So I just think America has a limited collective memory when it comes to studying the presidents, learning about the presidents. And so I think these are some of the easier ones to jettison, right? They weren't necessarily chosen because they were the best people. Two out of the five became president after the president died. They were vice president. Obviously, their solutions did not stand the test of time and helped precipitate a civil war in which 2% of Americans were killed.
Yeah.
So I think it's all of these reasons that we choose not to remember these people, but you can't understand the Civil War without understanding these five former presidents who lived to see it and the decisions they made and what they accomplished and what they failed to accomplish, what they believed about the country and what the country really was.
Did any of them do anything that was strikingly wonderful?
In their administration?
Yes.
I think Millard Fillmore gets a lot of criticism for supporting the Compromise of 1850. But I think, in truth, the Compromise of 1850 could have held and could have held because, you know, the people who were interested in compromise at this period, they weren't interested in compromising on slavery forever. They wanted to compromise it past the point where other factors could come into play and try to kill it out. You know, they thought if they could delay a civil war for another generation, perhaps they'd have a real shot at abolishing slavery or gradually emancipating slaves. And so I think 1850, that compromise certainly could have held. They called it it's a final solution. It's a final settlement of all of our problems as a country. Everything here is addressed in this compromise. And 4 years later, it's totally undone by the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which opens the Great Plains to slavery.
Right.
And so I think Fillmore is actually really one of the better antebellum presidents and deserves to be. You know, Millard Fillmore's name is a punchline today. He's a joke. And I think that's very unfair. I think it demonstrated a lot of leadership on his part to sign the compromise legislation and to stand up to two states at the time, Texas and South Carolina, who with military force behind him. And to get them back into line. I think he was a much better president than he gets credit for. Mm.
Let's go to Jay in Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Jay.
How are you?
All right, how are you?
I'm good.
Good.
I'm good. I want to share a funny story quickly and then ask a question about the parallels of what we're talking about here, what you're talking about, and today, and what I see is president and congressional overreach and or underreach, depending on how you look at it, based on the historical context that you set. But quick story is that my family were together over July 4th. We met what I essentially would call our great uncle, who's 91 years old, fought in World War II, was mentored and supervised by an older gentleman who knew and had spent time with, and the joke was shook the hand of Abraham Lincoln. So my 10 and 12 and 15-year-old kids got to then officially shake Uncle Calvin's hand, who had once removed shaken the man's hand who knew Abraham Lincoln. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was a funny coincidence.
Yeah.
And my mind is reeling with the conversation that's going on here, to the point of taking down the guest name and going back and look at some of his books about what's happening today with the Supreme Court and the Obama administration, and even going back to maybe even the Bush administration, how acts that are going on today to potentially save or not save what is constitutional, what's not constitutional. Because you're having that same discussion, but it goes back 150 years, and it's interesting to me because I'm learning as I'm hearing you guys talk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you raised two very, very good points. Number one, the idea that you could shake the hand of someone who shook the hand of Abraham Lincoln belies the fact that this is it's not far removed from our time, you know, this Civil War. It seems so surreal, Americans killing Americans at 10,000 locations throughout the United States. It seems so remote. It seems so foreign, and it's not. It's, you know, we're celebrating the 150th anniversary of the events of 1864 right now. And next year we'll be celebrating the 150th anniversary of the closing of the war. And so these are events that are very closely removed to us in our history, events that we cannot understand America truly without understanding. And then second, you know, I love history, and I think history has some of the greatest stories ever, stories that would not be believed if they came from a fiction author's pen. But I think it's not just useful as a good story. It's useful if it holds up a mirror to us and gives us some perspective on the world we're living in now. So one of the things we need to understand is when we get pessimistic and when we get cynical about politics, we have to understand that it was once so much worse in this country, to the point where we engaged in a civil war where 2% of us were killed. And so no matter how concerned we are, you know, my epilogue is titled Do Not Despair of the Republic. And it was a saying from the Romans, and it was a saying that the former presidents in the book often repeated, do not despair of the Republic. And so I would encourage my readers and your listeners, Kathleen, not to despair of the Republic. We have always found a way through our most difficult situations as a country in the past. And you know, I think whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, I think there's been a widespread concern. Has this country had the leadership it's needed over the past 10, 20 years? Have we had the right kind of leadership in America? And I think too often the answer is no, we don't have leadership in the White House, leadership in Congress that matches the integrity, the wisdom, the good judgment, the exceptionalism of the people they represent. But while that is the case, America once had this antebellum period where we had a series of very weak leaders and leaders who were not up to the task. But out of that period came an Abraham Lincoln. And so there's always great, great reasons to be optimistic about America's future.
Yeah, I understand that optimism. And yet you had a whole series of kind of lackluster presidents who, if they had been more effective and if the leadership had matched the times, we may have averted a horrendous civil war.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think about all the problems we face today as a country and how many of those problems could have been averted by strong presidential or congressional leadership over the past 10, 20, 30 years. Mm-hmm. So we've also, I think, seen this in the modern era. If we think about which of our modern presidents, our post-World War II presidents, are we really going to be talking about 150 years from now, the way we talk about Abraham Lincoln, right? And so I have that hope that that effective leadership is around the corner for this country, because we certainly need it. We have a whole host of very serious issues to address. Mm.
Thank you very much, Jay, for your call from Florida. And thank you, Chris, so much. You're just a wonderful guest. I wouldn't have thought, I don't know when I would have thought about Millard Fillmore again in my whole life if you hadn't read this book or any of these people. And I feel like I'm missing something and not missing it anymore.
Fillmore Lovers Unite.
Yeah, right. Okay, we'll end on that note. Thank you very much for being with us.
And Kathleen, if I could, really quick, encourage your listeners to visit my website. It's chrisderosebooks.com, and it's very easy to contact me on there. So if you didn't get a chance to ask a question on the show, or if you pick up the book and you have a question, I would love to hear from you. It's Chris. DeRoseBooks.com. And thank you so much, Kathleen, for giving me time to talk to your listeners about this. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah, it was. It was a great pleasure. Chris, and it's D, capital D, E, R, O, S, E. The book is The President's War, Six American Presidents and the Civil War That Divided Them. So you'll learn a lot about John Tyler and Martin Van Buren, James Buchanan, Millard Fillmore, and Franklin Pierce, and of course, Abraham Lincoln. Thanks to Judith Sears Poisson for producing this show, and thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. Soccer, the first hour of tomorrow's program, and Presidential Libraries, hour two.